This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Today, we're talking about how Indiana and its communities have responded to the COVID-19 pandemic and how the state could improve in the coming months. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. You can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Today, we're joined by two guests. We have Brian Dixon, the director of the Public Health Informatics at the Regan Streiff Institute, and also an associate professor of epidemiology at the IUPUI School of Public Health. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. We also have Barbara Aguiano, a health and science reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, Taylor.
Well, thank you both for taking time to be here with us this afternoon. Brian, I wanted to start with you. Let's start from the very beginning when COVID-19 reached the United States. What was Indiana's initial response to this nationwide spread?
Yeah, so the initial response to the spread here was really getting prepared to detect it and then begin to sort of monitor it. So public health often sets up surveillance activities at the beginning of an outbreak like this. So there was, they were taking cues from the CDC, from the federal government, of course, watching the news as all of us were, as the virus kind of spread through China and then began to move through Europe. So I think at the beginning of this, Indiana was really preparing itself first by setting up its state-run laboratory to be able to do the test for the virus. That's typically the first thing that you have to have in place so that you can even find out when you have cases in your jurisdiction.
Now, what about when Indiana got its first case? Was the state able to prepare for that when we determined we did have our first COVID case?
I would say probably yes and no. So we were prepared in the sense that the laboratory, could run those tests and started running those tests in late February to determine if patients had the virus here. And then, of course, we had our first case that was detected by that laboratory. But no, in the sense that at that time, there really wasn't and still hasn't really emerged a really coordinated federal plan. So it was sort of unclear as to what Indiana probably needed. They probably were trying to wait for some guidance from the CDC as to what they should do. By the time we had our first case, there were many cases already in Seattle and in New York City. So I think the state was sort of preparing its plans. But in the initial phase, we were probably asking a lot of questions than we had answers to at the time they detected that first case in the state.
Right. I think that was probably the case nationwide. I think most were probably just caught off guard by the spread. So when we had our first initial case, what do you think the state's response was as far as the spread? Do you think that we did pretty well in responding to that?
Well, I think because we were caught off guard, we really weren't as sort of, prepared as we could have been. Now, I will say we issued the stay-at-home order within 2 weeks of that first case. So the first case came on March 6th, and I believe that our stay-at-home order began on March 20th. So it really was only a two-week period of time. It feels like forever because that's how time feels right now in this pandemic. But it was a fairly quick response to move from detecting the first case to shutting everything down. Unfortunately, we didn't have a lot of other options because essentially we were looking at what was going on in New York City, what was going on in Seattle, what had gone on in Italy, and sort of, decided to sort of move from one end of the pendulum to the other without having a lot of other good options, for example, really didn't have a plan ready to go once we detected that first case. So it was really about sort of assessing the situation, knowing that things will probably get pretty bad unless we took some dramatic action, which the state did take within a 2-week period.
Right. It seemed like things moved pretty quickly after that. We continued to see more cases.
Yeah, and that's because it probably was actually spreading through the population in late February, even before we detected the first case. So I think now there's a lot of evidence that's come out that the virus was really in the country earlier than February in the U.S. And it probably was in Indiana well before that first case from those people who had traveled to Boston. We've seen, for example, people who were in the hospital in February with what we would now call COVID-like illness, but they never got a test because we weren't routinely testing people back then. So we're pretty sure it came sooner than that. We also saw a lot of people get it from, indoor events like sectional basketball games in early March before the stay-at-home order went into effect. And so outcomes like that show us that, we weren't prepared, I guess, as we could have been for preventing those types of transmissions in the early days of the pandemic.
Right. Palmer, how long have you been covering stories around COVID-19 and the pandemic? You've been doing a great job, by the way.
Thank you so much. I actually moved back to Indiana from North Dakota in August. So while I was kind of following, what was going on here because I have family here, I really didn't jump in until stage five happened. So I just kind of got to see a lot of sort of that transition into, from the summer months of people being outside and doing all sorts of activities outside to really that transition of like, all right, now we're going to see what the fall kind of has in store for us.
Right. Well, what can you say about Indiana's response to the pandemic compared to states like North Dakota?
Well, definitely North Dakota did not implement a mask mandate right away or any sort of real mandates. There were, changes made to dining to not try to have people too close together in proximity. But I would say that Indiana had a little bit more of an aggressive stance than North Dakota did. And we can see that North Dakota's response sort of, ended up contributing to, or lack of response ended up really contributing to the numbers that they were seeing, 2 weeks ago, a month ago.
Right. Indiana experienced, seemed like it was pretty heavy there as far as the number of cases and during the summer. And since you got here in August, was there anything when you started looking at this here in the state that you wanted to focus on specifically?
I think how the the interaction or the crossing of flu season with COVID-19 was one of the things that caught my eye pretty quickly. Mostly because there had been sort of this comparison to COVID-19 being, just a really bad flu or, something similar to the flu. So I think that was an interesting sort of thing that the state jumped on right away, urging people to get flu shots, just to sort of avoid the hospitalization rates going up. That and just, what fall and winter, would look like, once people started moving events and activities indoors because Indiana winters are so cold, much like North Dakota ones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What, you've done reporting on smaller communities and counties across the state. What kinds of problems have you seen around the messaging for COVID testing?
So it feels like a lot of communities are trying to adapt statewide messaging to better fit their communities, be it, language barriers, sort of the ability of businesses to adapt to the restrictions or to the guidelines the state is setting. As far as, you know, can I fit, how many people can fit into the business, what kind of hours to be kept. So I think that a lot of places are really adapting that. The other thing that's been popping up a lot more seems to be mask mandates, and sort of how local communities are starting to have a little more teeth in their messaging. I looked at Monroe County, and, you know, one of the things they do is there's fines, but it really impacts businesses more than individuals. But that's a sort of, you know, route that Monroe County itself took when they assessed their community and where they were seeing bigger issues.
All right. Brian, can you respond to the COVID testing a little bit as far as how you think it's gone?
Yeah. So I think, on the one hand, I think the state did a good job in setting up a testing infrastructure pretty quickly. Everyone recognized, I think, at the state that there needed to be testing. That's part of kind of the three things that public health should be doing in order to drive down the rate of infection is you have to know where infections are before you can isolate and quarantine people. So you really have to have a robust testing infrastructure. So the state very quickly, you know, with the help of a contractor, set up all these sites around the state, made that testing available for free to people. Initially, I think that the initial strategy was really focused on people who were symptomatic, and that's just because there were very few test kits available for COVID-19 testing at the beginning of the pandemic. We still face shortages of test kits, even though we're testing many more people now, but we're really kind of again, at a point of capacity. So, but I think it was a good thing that the infrastructure was set up to do the testing, and that over time, there's been more emphasis on broadening out who's getting tested, because that's really what you want. And that's what we all wish we would have had at the beginning of this, was that kind of infrastructure and broad scale testing.
All right. Well, I'd like to talk more about COVID testing. But we're going to take a little quick break here, and we'll be right back with our guest. We're talking about what went well and what went wrong in the state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Again, if you have questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. We're talking today about the state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We'd love your questions and comments on this topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store and send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. Brian, I wanted to get back with you before our break. We were talking about COVID testing. Do you think there's any specific changes that could help get the messaging about COVID testing out there to reach different communities across the state?
Yeah, I think with respect to testing, our communication strategy has kind of been, you know, single channel, right? Focused on, you know, getting information, for example, to the media like WFYI and other stations, which is good. That's a normal part of public health practice. So that's important to get information out to news media. But I think, as we've seen, there are many populations in the state that don't necessarily tune into news media on a regular basis, either because English is not a language they understand very well, or because they prefer other media platforms. So I think one of the things that I think that would have helped, and that we still have time to do, is to produce media in multiple languages and push media out on different platforms to reach a variety of audiences.
Now, Barbara, in your reporting, as far as problems with the messaging around COVID testing, do you think it's affected different communities as well?
Yes, and you know, for the feature that I did around sort of that topic, Brian and I kind of had the conversation about communities really reaching, helping to reach people in these communities that, you know, for one reason or another might not understand the process of, you know, testing of testing of how to do preventative work, you know, how to use PPE or just really the rules that, you know, messaging changes. And when we have messaging that's sort of right now very county specific, you know, if you're traveling to one county or traveling to another county or these smaller communities, these cities like Elkhart that are doing their own sort of thing with, you know, what how to best protect their residents. I think it can become overwhelming if you're not, you know, if it's not in your language. So I think that, yeah, the communities as far as having those community representatives that can explain this to their communities really, really makes a difference.
Are there any communities in the state that could need more help than others?
I think there's a big a disparity there when it comes to communities that necessarily don't speak the same language. So I'm thinking Spanish-speaking communities in particular, you know, Burmese community in Fort Wayne. So there's just so much diversity in the state, and it doesn't even necessarily come down to languages. It could also come down to, you know, the size of these communities, like Scott County, who is a good example of, you know, one of the biggest lessons their health department says they learned from the HIV outbreak in 2015 was we need to have direct communication with community leaders and people who can reach out to everyone and make sure people don't get left behind.
Right. Now, when we look at contact tracing, that can be complicated all its own. And Brian, can you give us kind of a little summary and describe, I guess, what the contact tracing process looks like so we can kind of get a better sense of what goes into the tracing?
Yeah, so when a new case is detected, it really kind of flows up to the state's system that they set up for contact tracing, which is kind of outsourced to a company that has a call center. So that call center essentially sends the person a voicemail, yeah, not a voicemail, but they call them, they send them an email, they send them text messages. So they use multiple ways to try to reach out to the person based on the information they have about that person, and then they hope to get a hold of them and ask them then a series of questions. If they can't get a hold of them, then the case is kind of referred down to the local health department for follow-up. So that's the typical process that the state is using to try and reach out to people.
And that's the thing, is getting a hold of those people. Do you think it's working?
There's only a no, the short answer is no. There are a lot of people who are ignoring the texts and the emails and the phone calls. Like if and I can't blame a lot of people because unfortunately it comes through your phone as, you know, a foreign number that you don't recognize. They've been trying to work with that with the telecom companies and not having a whole lot of luck, just given the fact that there's so many places now using call centers to call out to people. So I don't blame people for ignoring the calls. We've been trying to be proactive about telling people, you know, please pick up that call, but then this time of year, there's so many scammers out there trying to also call you that we don't blame people for ignoring it. So really that the methods that we're using are simply not working.
Well, not to put the blame on contact tracing and the lack of response to it, but do you think maybe that could be part of the problem why there are so many cases that people may have been exposed and they're not aware of it?
Yes. So we know that if, you know, for example, contact tracing can't get a hold of you within the first couple of days, you are, you know, potentially likely to be out there, may not feel any symptoms. You may still go back to work. You may be forced to go back to work. And so you are out in the community potentially spreading it. And if the contact tracers aren't able to get a hold of the people that you might have been around right before you tested positive, then they can't proactively reach out to those people to let them know that they were potentially exposed and should be isolating themselves for a period of time, again, propagating that single infection into potentially multiple new ones in the community.
Yeah. Does the process look the same across the state, or do some counties follow different protocols?
Some parts of the county are using different processes. In fact, recently the state changed, so they were taking a few days to refer that case down to the local health departments. Now they're trying to do that within 24 hours to speed up the process. Some counties, like Marion, are using a process where, in addition to calling people and trying to get a hold of them on the phone, they are also sending individuals out into the community, going door to door to find people and do that contact tracing in person, essentially, of course, at a distance and with masks and everything, but trying to do it kind of old school, if you will, public health boots on the ground to increase their ability to reach people quickly after learning about the infection.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, can you talk about why the way that we do contact tracing doesn't work for some communities?
So kind of going back to, back to sort of the language barrier aspect of it, mm-hmm. And sort of the distrust in a lot of, I don't want to say just plain distrust in government, but certainly there's issues that shape the trust certain communities have with the government. So when there's a lot of questions about a lot of highly personal information, I think that that really weighs in on how open people are to answering those questions. There is the language barrier for some communities, and it's difficult when a lot of the information surrounding something like COVID isn't available in your specific language. So outreach is kind of an issue there. And really just, there's a lot to do also with, I'm thinking Hispanic community in particular. There's added risks of seeking help that we've seen with other issues, sort of like with the census, what is this information going to be used for? Am I being targeted for something else like deportation? Or there's just been sort of a compilation of issues that have really caused so much distrust that I think, sort of like Brian mentioned, when you get a phone number that doesn't necessarily, that doesn't necessarily say, where it's from, or is a sort of a really vague number, I think your instinct is, do I really want to answer this?
In talking to local officials, do you find that they are trying to address this issue and reaching more of that demographic?
I think so. I think there's been examples, of communities trying to do sort of outreach programs. I'm thinking like, a community group in South Bend, La Casa de Amistad, they've really pushed PPE and social distancing and some social and have adjusted things. They'll normally have information available in Spanish for residents because that's the community they serve. So I think a lot of local communities or community organizations have really taken the lead into sort of trying to help mitigate, what COVID's done, and really try to encourage people to get tested, to go ahead and answer those contact tracing calls because it's important.
All right. Oh, Brian, kind of going back to the statewide regulations, you mentioned they could be improved. What approach is the state taking in terms of setting statewide regulations?
right now, unfortunately, not much. We did not hear a whole lot from the governor on Wednesday about new regulations. He is going to put forth a new executive order tomorrow, but it seems to be focused primarily on, having the hospitals reduce their elective surgeries to kind of free up space in the hospitals for more COVID patients, not necessarily focused on prevention of new infections. So we still have the statewide mask mandate, which is a statewide order. So that's still out there and encouraged to do universal masking. But there haven't really been any proposed new lockdowns or restrictions at the state level. It's really been left up to the local health departments to make those determinations.
Would it surprise you that if we could have another lockdown?
Well, it would surprise me given that, unfortunately, the coronavirus has turned into a very political topic rather than being focused on people's health and well-being. So the politics may not be in favor of, another lockdown like some other states have done in the recent weeks. But that certainly would be one thing that would help. I think we've seen that in the spring, the lockdowns were very helpful in bending the curve in the hospitals. They weren't near as at capacity like they are now. And also we've seen recently in Europe where countries that put in lockdowns last month in November in response to the rising rates in October, those countries are now seeing major declines in new cases as well as hospitalizations because they put those restrictions in place for 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, the cases continue to climb. It's not getting any better. Do you think that a lockdown, there's hesitation to doing a lockdown for whatever reason, even though the cases continue to increase?
I do think there's hesitation to do a lockdown because we've seen that people protest when there are lockdowns and people protest when you implement curfews or when you, they're still continuing to protest about wearing masks. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately those viewpoints are, across the spectrum in Indiana, and that plays a role in the decision making. And so there is hesitancy about putting more restrictions in place because there was a lot of rhetoric, as frankly, during the election that said, if you elect such and such person, then we're probably going to have, a lockdown. And so some people voted to prevent lockdowns rather than, vote for, someone who had a strategy necessarily to keep people healthy.
Right. Well, and then you look at the other side of it, too. The lockdown impacted so many as far as jobs are concerned, and businesses were greatly affected by a lockdown.
Oh, absolutely. You're right. There's no doubt that lockdowns have a tremendous impact on multiple parts of the society, and people need to continue to go to work to make a living in many cases. And so no one wants to see people financially harmed in order to protect their kind of, physical health. But, you have to look at the range of options and put some protections in place. Marion County has, for example, and Allen County and other counties have put restrictions in place beyond the statewide mask order in order to do something to try to limit infections in their jurisdiction.
Well, also this week, the governor put a cap again on social gatherings as far as, at the limits imposed by each county's metrics and the local health departments. Hoping maybe reducing the size of crowds and gatherings might make an impact.
Yes, that is certainly one thing that will, but we've seen this virus spread very effectively in small gatherings just as well as large gatherings. You really have to have a combination of measures in place in order to limit transmission. For example, in the education setting, we've seen that when you spread students out in the room and they all wear a mask, and you kind of cohort them together and put some other measures in place like you know, preventing drinking fountains and limiting sort of contact outside of your class or your bubble, that can be effective to keep people safe in those environments. But, you know, a classroom is not, you know, does not exceed the state limit. But if we got rid of the masks and we had everybody crowd in there at, you know, 40 kids in a classroom, then we probably would see more transmission. So It's the combination of both the limiting of gatherings, but also the additional measures that I think we all need to make sure we have in place if we're going to get together with other people that will make the difference in beating this virus.
All right. Well, we'll have more to talk about when we come back. We'll be back after just a quick break. Thank you both. We're talking with a health expert and also a reporter about how Indiana and communities around the state have responded to the pandemic. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Or you can send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. I'm Taylor Bennett, and we'll be back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Back now to our discussion on how Indiana and its communities have responded to the COVID-19 pandemic. As always, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from. That number, 866-476-3881. And going back to both of you, you know, we've been talking about regulations and mandates and challenges and things. And I guess, Brian, have you seen different counties in Indiana face any challenges because of this so-called one-size-fits-all approach that the state has been following?
Yeah, I feel like many county health departments are under-resourced. I mean, before the pandemic, most of our counties, in fact, were under-resourced. You know, many counties have a part-time physician and a part-time nurse that makes up their public health department. And so it's very hard when you have a minimal staff and minimal resources to really mobilize in a pandemic situation. So they've really struggled, for example, to even follow up on all those referrals that they're getting from the contact tracing program. When you have very few human resources to do that work of reaching out to people who've been infected and gather that information and help them get access to the resources they need to isolate and remove themselves from the community for a while until they've recovered, that's very hard to do. And it's not like those health departments in those counties, for example, have a lot of, you know, cash on hand to hire new people. Some counties have. We've seen that happen in some of the larger counties where they've, you know, scraped the coins out of the, you know, sofa cushions in order to bring on some people to help, or they've reassigned people within the health department to do contact tracing. But some counties don't have those resources. We've also seen counties struggle with enforcement. Again, when you have a limited number of people and you, for example, have, you know, local law enforcement that's unwilling to enforce public health ordinances, that creates a lot of conflict and tension in those communities. And that's where, you know, state intervention might be necessary, or if nothing else, state acting as a mediator to help, you know, bring everybody on board to focus on prevention and health and well-being of the population over, you know, political or personal viewpoints.
What would a state intervention look like?
Well, so a state intervention could, for example, you know, set some minimal fines or you know, for example, maybe, you know, dispatching or loaning out, for example, either National Guard or state police to help local law enforcement, you know, enforce some of these ordinances. It could look like providing policies that would you know, kind of increase the penalty, if you will, for some of these violations, and then use that in a strategic way to find establishments that are willfully kind of ignoring the rules. I mean, there are a lot of business owners that have been very responsible in this pandemic, but there have been some, for example, that have willfully, you know, ignored public health ordinances in order to, make a profit.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, when you look at smaller communities, what do you think they need right now?
I think from, you know, the counties that I've checked in, you know, sometimes some cities, especially the ones that are dealing with hospitals that are seeing, you know, are at capacity right now. There's just been such a push to sort of normalize mask usage and really normalize just the rules that we all know. So I think that what those communities need right now is it seems like maybe a little bit more teeth to those sort of rules that we all know that we're already, you know, have set in place, like wear your mask, social distance, you know, wash your hands. Not to say that they're gonna, you know, fine people for not washing their hands. But it's, you know, I think that that's just been a big push, and it's been a big push to sort of get that message out and really try to normalize that, especially as we get more into, you know, these cases going higher and, just the hospitals really being, bombarded with having to deal with sort of the repercussions.
Do you think that people are taking more of a personal responsibility when you talk about the mask wearing? Do you think there's more on, I mean, obviously there's people who are not going to wear them, but do you think there's more of a personal responsibility now?
I think that the more that we, you know, that we try to make this, a reality and sort of anyway in my reporting, the more that I share these stories of what it looks like in hospitals every day and, you know, just the way that communities are normalizing it, I think that the personal responsibility aspect is sort of playing a bigger role. The numbers may not indicate it as of now, but you know, I think that there is some power in those stories being shared of people who have lost loved ones, hospital workers who are exhausted, you know, and there's some power to that personal responsibility to feeling like I've done my part to, you know, ensure that I don't spread it if I have it, you know, by simply doing something as easy as wearing a mask.
You have covered the stories of healthcare workers, and it's been pretty impactful listening to them talk about how they continue to see people die and how loved ones are responding. In your reporting, is there anything that has stood out to you that has made this pandemic especially, I mean, even more real than we already know that it is?
I think two instances for me, and it was both related to talking to doctors. The first one that made it a reality for me, you know, and this is me working from home in my safe sort of bubble, was talking to Dr. Patterson in South Bend, and sort of just hearing how exhausted he was. And kind of just pleading with people, but still sort of, during his interview, you know, I remember him saying, you know, we know that there's people that are doing the right thing. We know that there's people who are still wearing their masks and doing what they need to. So kind of seeing that, hearing that hope in his voice, I guess, really stuck out to me. And it's something that I think about a lot. And then there's Dr. Yoletti in Indianapolis, who I spoke to for the feature, and sort of his also take, I wouldn't say exhaustion on his part, but his sort of resilience. You know, he went from treating the first case to just trying to figure out how he's going to make it work if numbers keep rising the way they do. And those two, for some reason, I don't know if it's their voice or, you know, just being so entrenched in that moment. I think those two interviews have really just made COVID that much realer to me, you know. And I mean, like, I cover it every day, so like, it's real. But that just kind of, when I say my heart sinks, like, my heart sinks just thinking about those interviews.
Right. And hearing their personal story and how they've been impacted, it does make it very real.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brian, what do you think Indiana should be doing right now to focus on this problem, considering where we're at right now with the numbers?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we really should be focusing on identifying I think we know them by now, the high-risk populations, and really working with them to, one, reinforce messaging, and that might mean reaching out in different ways to reach those populations, and two, doing what we can to, you know, provide additional sort of testing, which is difficult because there's long lines now, and, you know, we've seen a lot of backlogs in testing recently, but we really should be, you know, even amplifying our testing strategy particularly with those high-risk populations to identify cases early and get people into isolation. And then really encouraging people to take it as personal responsibility, to own this, and do what they can to limit their interaction with others for the next little while. I really think, you know, we're not going to see a mandatory lockdown, but if we as a community were to agree to some kind of voluntary, like, you know, staying at home, or at least minimizing as much as possible our interactions with one another for a couple weeks, we could once again bend the curve and make a big difference in driving down infections and hospitalizations, because our frontline healthcare workers deserve a break. They've been working way too hard for now almost 2 months, because we've seen just steady increase after increase after increase, and they really deserve a break this time of year, just like many of us are going to take in a couple weeks.
Well, you know, we ask people to limit the social gatherings. I mean, you know, we're in the midst of the holidays and people gathered around Thanksgiving. And it seemed like, you know, there's now been a spike in the cases, and we got Christmas coming up again. Do you think people are going to heed to that warning of maybe staying away from family for Christmas?
I think there's two camps, and I think, you know, a good number of people will not get together. They will heed that advice, but I think there's a good number of other people that unfortunately are going to ignore the advice and get together around the holidays. And those activities, you know, the family gatherings, the New Year's parties, those are absolutely the best environment for this virus to spread from someone. All it takes is one person being there to spread the virus to a bunch of other people at that event. And so we really need to encourage people to think twice about having those events. But unfortunately, given how Thanksgiving turned out, I don't have a lot of hope that everyone will heed the message.
Well, we have the vaccine that's going to be made available soon in the state, though not, you know, everywhere is going to have access to that. What's your thoughts on the vaccine? Do you think that we're going to get it into the hands, obviously, first? And, you know, we're getting into those in the nursing homes and teachers and those. Do you think that's going to hopefully help in the next few months?
It's going to help, yes, but it's going to take a while before we start to see major protection at the community level for the virus from these vaccines. So people are not, you know, immediately protected when they get the first dose of the vaccine. It takes several days for that kind of first dose to really start to take effect, and then you're really not fully protected until after the second dose. And so we're going to see several months where we will still need to take precautions, because not everyone in the community will have access to it right away, but also just because those who are getting access, it will take a while for them to become sort of fully protected. And so we're really looking at next summer before we really should have enough people protected that we would be able to, for example, loosen some restrictions like social distancing and mask wearing.
It could take a while. Are you aware of any changes to the state's response that we know of that may be happening soon in the short term besides the vaccine?
No, the real focus right now is on the vaccine plan, to get that out as quickly as possible once it's approved by the FDA. That's really a lot of the focus right now, as well as really trying to do whatever we can to beef up the existing things that we have in place, like contact tracing and testing. But there really is nothing, beyond, I think, what was said at the press conferences this week, that may be coming forth in terms of additional protections.
As far as we know, yeah. Barbara, do you have anything planned as far as your reporting is concerned that you're going to be focusing on over the next few months?
I think there's definitely going to be a focus on vaccine sort of rollout and, what that's going to look like, what that's going to mean for communities across the state. And really, you know, at least my plan going in has always been to give a voice to the numbers that we're seeing and sort of reading, because I think numbers can tell you so much of a story, but until you add a human, aspect to it, it just becomes another number, unfortunately.
And as far as the numbers are concerned, do you think those are going to go down, do you think, in the next few months? Do you foresee that happening?
Hard to say. Like Brian mentioned, you know, Thanksgiving was kind of the first test. And we're still kind of trying to figure out what that's looking like with Christmas and sort of New Year, you know, in the next few weeks. I hope so. Deep down, I really, really hope so. But with that first test of Thanksgiving, it's hard to say. We're still trying to look at what that's, you know, the impact that had right now. So,
and it seemed like, you know, this time, usually any other time, we'd be talking about the flu. You had mentioned that earlier about, you know, people getting the flu shot. And now we're going to be talking about making sure people get the COVID vaccine.
Yeah, so that's something also, you know, I plan to circle back on, sort of what the flu shot has, you know, if the messaging on that worked, and sort of, you know, pay attention to specifically what the messaging is going to be around the COVID vaccine, and really see, you know, who's being targeted, if there were any lessons learned from how we message the flu shot and the importance of it. So that'll be coming your way, I guess, relatively soon here.
Well, we'll definitely look forward to your reporting. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to join us today. Very informative and lots of great information. Today we had Brian Dixon, the Director of Public Health Informatics at the Regenstrief Institute, also an Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the IUPUI School of Public Health. And Barbara Aguiano is a Health and Science Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Our producers, Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason, Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you would like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere that you get your podcast. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Taylor Bennett. Thanks for listening. This is All In.